creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
Winona LaDuke is an Ojibwe enrolled member of the Mississippi Band Anishinaabeg, who lives and works on the White Earth Reservations. She is the mother of three children and is also the executive director of Honor the Earth, where she works on a national level to advocate, raise public support, and create funding for frontline Native environmental groups. Winona LaDuke is an internationally acclaimed author, orator, and activist, a graduate of Harvard and Antioch universities with advanced degrees in rural economic development. On this episode of Culture Click, we bring you LaDuke's talk as presented at Frozen River Film Festival on the campus of Winona State University. In the talk, Winona will discuss how fracking and energy pipelines pose a threat to our environment.
What we say up north is love water, not oil. We figure it's pretty clear you can live without one and not the other. And I feel like that is this moment in time to figure out which way we're going.
I'm Terry Tunset, and you're listening to Culture Click.
I'm mostly a writer. Most of my life I've worked in my own community or some other Native community, largely trying to just do the right thing, I'd say. A long time ago, my father said to me, came to see me when I was at Harvard, and he was a guy who graduated from the eighth grade. He was a smart guy, though. He said to me one day, he said, Winona, I don't want to hear your philosophy if you can't grow corn. And so that's what I'd really like to do. Grow corn, put up some wind turbines, live this good life that the Creator gave us. And I find that I've spent a lot of my life fighting these projects that make no sense to me and really make no sense to those who are ahead. So as I think of where we're going and where we are, I think about this time now. This month in our language, this month is called Namib in Aegisis, which means a sucker moon. The moon that follows it is a moon known as Onab on Aegisis, or the freezing over moon, or when the snows, hard-crusted snow, when it's, you know what I mean, when it thaws and freezes again and thaws, it gets hard, and then also known as the moon, you don't want to do a face plant in the snow, right? Iskigami Zigigizis, that's our maple syruping moon that follows that, that's around April. Is that about the same down here? Wabagon Aegisis, our flower moon. Then we have our Odamen Aegisis, that's our strawberry moon. We have Mean Aegisis, our blueberry moon. Then we have Menominike Aegisis, our wild rice-making moon. Then we have a moon called Watibaga Aegisis, which is when the leaves change color. Banakwayo Aegisis, when the leaves fall. Gashkadan Aegisis, that's a moon that's around November. That's freezing over. Freezing over moon. That's what they call that moon. And then the moon that follows that is Manitou Gizasoon's little spirit moon. Then Gishi Manitou Gizas, their great spirit moon. Then we are to this moon again. I tell you those moons, they're a little bit north of here, but I think that the ecosystem is similar. And I wanted you to hear our language. I wanted you to hear moons that are based on a land. And maybe you noted that none of those moons is named after a Roman emperor. What I want to say is that it's possible to have an entire worldview that has nothing to do with empire. We'll be okay. And that's kind of the question and the quandary, I think, of this time. In our teachings as Anishinaabeg people, we're told that this is a time when you have it's called the time of the seventh fire, and we're told that you have a choice between two paths. One path, they say, is well-worn, but it is scorched. That's what those prophets told our people a long time ago. They said, you're going to have a choice, and one path is well-worn, but it is scorched. And the other path is not well-worn, and it is green. And it is your choice upon which path to embark. And that's what these prophets told our people maybe 1,000 years ago. Told our people we'd have to make that choice. And what I know is probably what you know, is that that's kind of an American choice. Which way we're going to go. We're at this moment in time where we can essentially combust ourselves into oblivion. Where we can make some choices that are pono, always like that Hawaiian word, righteous choices. Righteous choices, and be people that our descendants will be proud of. That's what I kind of see us as. So I was asked to talk a little bit about the quandary that we are in, and a little bit about the communities that are resisting or in the midst of that. This is a picture of my sister. I like to show this picture because she is far more terrifying than I am. She is 6'2". And this is, I call her the Genghis Khan of the Ojibwe women. She headed up north. But what I would say is that this is a picture taken in Washington, D.C. last year. We were asked to join with the cowboys from Nebraska opposing the Keystone Pipeline. And the native people, the Lakota from South Dakota, in a ride on Washington, D.C. On April 21st on Earth Day. So we're on the Washington Mall and riding our horses. So it was called the Cowboys and Indians. And this is us. And of course, she had me placed really right towards the front, which was terrifying. As I was telling people earlier in the day, the place you do not want to be is on a horse on a street in Washington with all those cops and all those banners and all those photographers. Terrifying, terrifying. Anyway, I got another slide here. This is my friend Don. He's helping me. He does a lot of other things, but today he's being super helpful. This is some art, and I just wanted to share this with you. And I think Thane is here. We actually have some of these posters, but I don't know if any of you have seen this kind of art before. It's called ledger art. How many of you have seen it before? So, a long time ago, a lot of our people used to keep track of historic events. And they did this in a way of, it was called a winter count. And people, particularly in this area and west of here, would take elk hide or buffalo hide or deer hide, but largely those hides that are thicker. And they would take them and they would mark historic events in time. There's a winter count from about 1830 of when the snow was higher than the teepees. You know what I'm saying? These are records. There's a winter count that shows when the smallpox came to the Mandan people. 1825, 1826, these epidemics, they were recorded in these forms. And then what happened is that the buffalo were wiped out, and then a lot of those people were forced into prison camps. Right here, Fort Snelling was one of those prison camps. You all know some of these stories. This is southern Minnesota. But places like over in Fort Sill in Oklahoma, or Fort Robinson in Nebraska, or Fort Marion down there in Florida. And the people were carted down there in, pretty inhumane conditions, really. Let us just be honest about history. And when they were there, they continued to want to draw. And so, I don't know, Colonel Pratt or some others got the idea of giving them ledger paper. That's why this is called ledger art. It's art that records historic events. It was before movies. They record historic events like that. And so in my work, this pleasure I have of this life, I know a lot of artists, and so there's an artist named Michael Horse, who's one of the most prominent ledger artists, and I asked him to record the historic day of us going to Washington, D.C. to kill the Keystone XL pipeline. And that's what that is. It's called Death of the Black Snake. And that is a premonition that we have, that is how it looks. And I just want to say, so that's the Cowboys and Indians taking down the Black Snake. And I just want to make one note because, I like ledger art that is gender. There's full representation. So I was like, you got to have some women in the art, Michael. And so he's like, okay, when I put you, he says, what color is your horse? So that's me, green dress, black and white Appaloosa, okay? Just in case you're wondering. But anyway, I just wanted to show you that some of the forms that our struggle takes of resistance and how we are recording it. Let's see what the next slide is. This is what is going on in Indian country. I'm going to show you a little spectrum of not just Indian country. But Native people are in a position where we are landed people, although we have little land left. But it turns out what we have is where you have two-thirds of the uranium, one-third of all Western low-sulfur coal, single largest hydroelectric project in North America, our Native territories, the Athabascan tar sands, our Native territories, oil and gas, the fracking that is occurring in North Dakota, a quarter of it is occurring on what is known as the Fort Berthold Reservation, Manda and Hidatsa and Arikara homelands. And so throughout those territories, we are people that have been, you know, let us just be honest, besieged for a long time, you know, and what we have left is very difficult in the situation we're in. In some cases, like Fort Berthold, you had highly corrupt tribal governments, and at Navajo, you have a long history of a lot of this. This is a billboard taken out when, and this appeared last summer on the Navajo Nation when the tribal council decided to buy a 50-year-old coal strip mine from BHP Billiton, because BHP Billiton, the largest mining company in the world, decided it no longer wanted to hold the stranded asset of an old coal strip mine. You understand what I'm saying? With a few liabilities associated with it. So this is the Navajo people challenging the Navajo Tribal Council on that. Let's see what the next one is. This is, when I'm really bored, I buy billboards. This is a billboard that is on I-35 heading north to Duluth. I don't know if any of you have ever seen this. But as you gathered in work that we are doing in my community, we are fighting the Enbridge Company. And, you know, you saw a little bit from the video about our land. And I, you know, have spent a portion of my life working in other communities opposing bad energy projects, mostly these mines and some power plants. And there was one great proposal by NSP, now Xcel, right? They had these guys, some of you remember this story, private fuel storage. They're trying to figure out, you know, there's a little problem with the nuclear waste. We all know this, right? Like, it turns out there is no nuclear waste ferry. Did you notice this? I know that there is wishing that there is a nuclear waste ferry that would make that stuff disappear, but it has not disappeared, and there is not a nuclear waste ferry. And so private fuel storage was created by NSP, then I think Xcel. And what they wanted to do was to take the nuclear waste from all the from 12 utilities. And they're trying to find a place to get it. So they go out to the Skull Valley Goshute Reservation in Utah. And these people are in tough shape. Let us just be honest. You know, entirely tough shape, entirely ignored by the government. They're sitting next to a chemical waste dump, a Air Force base, a chemical weapons dump. They are surrounded, you know, in this case of incredible energy injustice or environmental injustice. And then these companies propose to bring a nuclear waste dump to their territory. And so I went out there to visit them, the Indigo Girls and I. I work with the Indigo Girls, and we go show up out there, and the tribal government, tribal councilman, you can see this house. You go down this road, it's all full of potholes. And you get down this road, keep driving, there's like dead cows on the road, because apparently it's cheaper for a farmer to have their cow hit to get the insurance settlement for it than to get that cow to market out there. It's like crazy stuff, right? We drive down this road, we get down there, and we pull into this tribal community. It's a dirt road. And you pull up there, and there's a tribal chairman's house, and it's giant. And he has, like, boats and trailers and big dish TV and everything. And then you go and see the community, and they're, like, living in these trailers. So I go see this guy named Sammy Black there. And I go look outside, and I'm like, what is NSP thinking? Like, where is the infrastructure for nuclear waste out here? You see this question that you got to start asking is, like, where are these Indians supposed to put this nuclear waste? Like, what's the infrastructure to take care of all this? And how's that going to work out? And I look out the window, and there's a buffalo in this guy's yard. And I said, Sammy, there's a buffalo in your yard. And he says, yeah. He says, NSP, Xcel Corporation, gave us that buffalo. And I was like, they gave you a buffalo? He said, yeah, they had some counseling on cultural correctness. And so they brought 5 buffalo down to give to us so that we would feel better negotiating with them about nuclear waste. I just tell you that story because it is like there's some crazy stories in Indian country, you know? And so we helped that community oppose successfully the tossing of a nuclear waste dump in their territory. I'll show you the next picture here. This is your problem. This is all of our problem. You got a pretty dirty one over there. How old is that coal plant? 60 years old? Something the French island, is that what it is? Really darn old, right? Really darn old, old school, like should be I was looking up in northern Minnesota, and they have this coal plant that's older than my mother. I was like, an 81-year-old should be a woman and not a coal plant. And I'm saying that's some old stuff, right? Super inefficient. Super inefficient. But anyway, this is what you got. And the combination of what you got, you guys are going to see some films on it, is giving us climate change. We're in this process of combusting ourselves to the edge of oblivion, and we're increasing the amount of CO2, the temperature, and we're causing a lot of disparities and crazy weather changes. This is a coal-fired power plant on the Navajo Reservation. And when I went down to work there in the late 70s, there was 5 coal plants, 4 coal strip mines, 43 uranium mines, and 10 uranium mills. In the meantime, only 85% of their houses had no electricity in them. That's what it looks like. So this is your problem. The next slide, Don. And this is your resistance a little bit to it. This is us up north this last summer. The next one, too. Yeah. This is some more people. These are Nebraska farmers, actually. This is at the Nebraska Public Utilities Commission last year. This is what people opposing climate change look like. These are people who believe that perhaps their water and their ecosystem is worth more than a Canadian corporation. You want to show the next slide? This is some more pictures from our community. Geez, that Michael looks crazy. And this here is from that climate march. Any of you go to that climate march in Washington, D.C.? That was cool, huh? In New York. That's right, in New York. That's when that climate march. There was how many of us there? 400,000 people. That climate march in Washington, D.C. So, you know, one of the reasons I was interested in coming down here to Winona is that you guys are at the epicenter of a lot of the frack sand mining that's going on all around you. And the movement to protect your bluffs and your land and your schools from silica and all the sand that blows off is really linked to the movement that all of these people are in their communities to protect it. Let's see what the next slides are. This is essentially what we are dealing with. We have got ourselves to a place where all of us were raised, I'm entirely a child of the fossil fuel era. So are most of you, I would assume. A few of you are a little bit older than me. But all we know is fossil fuels. And we live in a society that has become so addicted to fossil fuels that as Americans we consume about a quarter of the world's resources, and we consume more fossil fuels per capita, or more energy per capita than anybody in the world, except for one country. Anybody want to guess which country consumes more than us? If you were at my lecture earlier, you know. She doesn't want to say Canada. I was always trying to figure out, how could you consume more than an American? You know what I mean? I mean, we're like big, right? We're like super big consumers, but it turns out that Canada's colder, right? That's the only way I could figure you can consume more than us, right? So we've got to this place where we are heavily consuming, and we're consuming so much, and we're so addicted to fossil fuels. We entered this era where anything that was easy to get, we already got. You guys figured that out, right? And so the stuff we're going after now is stuff that it's hard to get. Hard to get is the, you know, it's called an era of extreme energy. What is extreme is when you blow off the top of 500 mountains in Appalachia, right? It's called mountaintop removal. And then we aren't even burning that coal anymore. We're exporting it. That's extreme behavior, right? What's extreme behavior? When you drill 20,000 feet down in the ocean to get something that's down there and you're hoping it's going to work out until you get the, what, deep water horizon, right? And then you realize you might have yourself a little problem where you got yourself in over your head. What's extreme behavior is when you do something like the Athabascan tar sands, where you basically end up trying to mine an area the size of Florida to stick it in some pipelines after you've done a bunch of crazy stuff to it and poison the water of an entire region, right? stick it in some pipelines to bring it down to America. And what is extreme behavior is exploding the bedrock of Mother Earth in order to get some gas and oil out that is not willing to be released without extreme measures, right? And that's what has happened, as we've become these people that are exercising extreme behavior. And the consequences of that are both in terms of civil and social society. You saw some of the footage before, and I have some more photos of it, where you have police and security forces defending fracking companies from Native people. It is extreme in terms of the social forces that you see. The movie Dear Governor Hickenlooper is going to be playing, what, on Saturday? In that movie, what you will see is the crisis of democracy which is occurring in Colorado, where municipality after municipality, about five of them, have banned fracking. And the governor of Colorado is suing them for trying to protect their water, right? That is the social impact, let alone the social impact of things like the drug trafficking and human trafficking that is occurring in the Bakken, right? There are the economic impacts of it, where you have a huge use of resources that are financial resources that is going into some energy projects, which in fact will be liabilities. They will not be assets. And then there are the environmental impacts. So this is a slide from my friend Bill McKibben. You guys know Bill McKibben from 350.org? How many of you know Bill? Can you guys raise your hands higher? I'm just old. I cannot see you if you like go like this. It's this organization called 350.org. I know that there's a few of them here. My friend Kathy Hallander, unless she decided to take a break. They're looking at this question of how to keep our climate from combusting itself into oblivion. And so I always like using this slide because he always says there's three numbers. And I like it because he gave me this slide and he also cannot size a slide, it turns out. So I just leave it like there so every time I pull it up I say, yep, that Bill can't size a slide. Anyway, so there's three numbers you got to remember as we're looking at what's going on. First one is 2 degrees. And we all know that basically y'all got this thing about the 2 degrees, right? You do not want the temperature to keep going up because we don't know what's going to happen. We know that the oceans are going to rise. You know that you keep putting, you know, CO2 out there and it turns out it keeps going into the ocean. But what happens when it goes into the ocean, right? It acidifies the ocean is what happens. So it keeps going in there and then your ocean gets to be an ocean on acid. You can only combust so much and you can only raise the temperature so much. So 2 degrees is what you want to keep it below. This is the second number. This is what my colleague was trying to pull these three numbers up earlier today. 565 gigatons of carbon. That's the total amount of carbon you can combust to keep it below 2 degrees, right? I don't really know how much that is. It's a lot. I actually have no idea. It seems like a lot, though. 565 gigatons. You know, it seems like you could put yourself on a diet and keep it to that. Like in some kind of theory in my head, right? 565 gigatons is how much you can combust. And then there's the third figure. This is the figure you don't want. This figure represents the amount of carbon held on the books by fossil fuel companies as assets, as reserves. So this is what Exxon, this is what Syncrude, this is what Arch Coal, this is what Cloud Peak, this is what Billiton, Navajo Nation has. That's how much they're holding as assets, and they are still exploring for new fossil fuels. Herein lies part of the quandary of where we are at as a society, and kind of the economics quandary that we place ourselves in these universities. Because what business school will tell you and what economics class here, probably at Winona State, will tell you is that that's an asset. They're holding reserves, right? And what I will tell you, and I think that you know in your gut, is that's not an asset, that's a liability. It's a planetary liability. The question is how to keep, this represents 5 times more than the amount of carbon that we can actually consume. And so the battles that are our frontline battles to keep it in the ground are really essential battles for human health, essential battles for planetary health. There is no easy strategy to do that. One of the strategies that is in the movement, give it a try, is this. You guys have heard of the divestment movement? I don't know what Winona State is doing on looking at divestment, but I know that a number of universities are looking at divestment nationally. A number of pension funds, a number of major foundations. In fact, the day after the climate march in New York, I think it was Rockefeller Brothers Fund. Do you guys remember this, reading this in the New York Times? Or in Rockefeller Brothers Fund announced that it was going to divest of $500 million worth of fossil fuel assets. And what is interesting about that, I think that you all know, is Rockefeller Brothers Fund made its money on fossil fuels, right? And they're doing that because climate change does not discriminate based on class or race, right? It does not even discriminate based on geography. If you're one of those nice retired people down in Florida, the chances of the ocean rising around you is actually pretty high. And your beachfront property is not going to be worth a lot, right? It is across the board. So this is a piece of the strategy. And then this is what you do with your money. You know, the fact is that there is a movement across this country, whether it is a student divestment movement or grassroots movements of ranchers or farmers, northern lakeshore owners, native people, students, that are saying, it is time to do the right thing. It is time to do the right thing. There is no absolutely easy answer, but there is some elegance in a transition. This is Indian country's map of kind of the solution, and I have to laugh because it's only half of the country, but say you took that money that is invested in fossil fuels and you decided to do something good with it. What would that future look like? You know, that is really the question of how you make that transition. And I think a lot of you know what that transition would look like. This is Indian country's contribution to it. It turns out that Indian reservations, go figure, I have no idea how this happened, but it turns out that Indian reservations are the windiest place in the country. I don't know why, but we're really super windy. It's like you go out there to some of those reservations, like the Blackfeet Reservation, I always tease those guys, they gotta walk like this, you know, because it's so windy out there. This is in Montana, right? They have class 7 wind or higher on a lot of those reservations, and you can see it for these maps. And so it is not that there is an absence of opportunity to invest your money. It's a question of political will, economic will, social will, and a moral conscience as to what we're going to do. Next one. This is a project I worked on down at Navajo. You guys have all these down here. I mean, you know, I'm coming down to Winona and the whole region. You have both the craziness of frack sand mining, and then you have this huge organic industry, right? You have a lot of local farms, and you have some renewable energy projects. This is what it looks like in Indian country. This is a solar project I worked on in a Navajo reservation. We used the leftovers, well, we'll call it the sulfur tax, basically, from a power plant that closed down, and they had to put it in an escrow account, and we used some of the money to solarize that facility on the Navajo Reservation. That was the largest project I was involved in, but pretty proud of that piece. The next one, Don. This is what solar thermal looks like. You guys have all seen this, right? I'm not showing you anything new. I'm trying to point out, though, that a lot of the solution involves community will, and it involves a set of choices. Those choices involve things like specifically taking energy from a large grid to a relocalized grid, where a lot of our power is produced locally. And in that process, we have a lot more accountability to each other. Now, not everybody, of course, can do that, but the fact is that, as we know, A lot of our houses are not only grossly inefficient, but in addition to that, the potential in a lot of houses of doing things like this. This guy, Henry Redcloud from Lakota Solar Enterprises, has put about 5,000 solar panels, I think, south-facing walls in tribal homes across the country. Turns out in the north, you guys are in the same canoe as us, it is still sunny in the winter, it's just darn cold, right? And that panel that guy has is about $2,000 and can save about 25% of your heating bills. And I think that's the way to go on a lot of them. So reduce your local consumption, increase your local efficiency. Then do things like, you know, revolutionary and smart countries like Germany and Denmark do. You know, they're so scary and left-leaning, right? Get a 30-year power from renewables so you don't end up in a continuous spiral towards with your own addictions. Next one, Don. This is kind of the choice. This is a picture from last summer in New Brunswick. I just don't like it. That's what a crisis in democracy looks like to me. A crisis in democracy looks like a private security force that is heavily armed invading an Indian community that is a Mi'kmaq community that does not want fracking. You know, that's a picture to me that you would expect to see maybe in El Salvador, not in a place called New Brunswick. And that's what I don't want to see. I don't want a ground war over fracking. You know, I don't want a ground war over pipelines. I'd rather have a democracy that works. Next slide. This is from that same community. That's a lot of RCMP that woman faced, you know. It takes some courage. There's those choices, and then there's better choices. This is 2 weeks ago in the Navajo Nation. About 60 of those women walked across the Navajo Nation from the proposed fracking fields, including around Chaco Canyon. You guys know where Chaco Canyon is? It's like a World Heritage Site. And they're fracking all around Chaco Canyon. And these women, there was about 70 of them, walked across the Navajo Reservation, carried some water to challenge their government to stop it. This is from New York. This is right before the cops came. I had two 14-year-olds in the hotel room. I said I could not get arrested. So in closing, I guess what I want to say is that we're at this moment in time, and I feel like you're going to watch a lot of great films during this festival. I'm going to watch some of them with you tomorrow. I want to show you a funny film that we did. But it's this moment where, you know, we're really privileged North Americans, all of us. In our privilege, we get this opportunity to take a breath. We're not in day-to-day crisis like a lot of people are in the world. We live in a society which has tremendous power and wealth and drives a lot of that which occurs in the world. And we're in a state that is at this crossroads. Because from where I sit up north to down here, you got a whole bunch of stuff coming your way that you didn't ask for. And what I'm saying is that up north, we have four pipelines we are facing that they're trying to run across those wild rice beds. That's a Canadian corporation. Well, three of them are a Canadian corporation. One's the Koch brothers. They could be owned by, I'm not sure. That they're trying to run across those rice beds, and we feel like that our water is worth more than their oil. And down here, you got a bunch of trains. We call them bomb trains. I don't know what y'all call them, but they look kind of flammable to me. And then you got a bunch of sand that's coming out of here. And our politicians and our regulatory authorities were not ready for what is happening in our state. Nobody was prepared for it. That's why we don't have the regulations to stop it. And so now is this time when you got to change that. What we say up north is love water, not oil. We figure it's pretty clear you can live without one and not the other, you know? And I feel like that is this moment in time. to figure out which way we're going. Our prophets came to us a long time ago and said we had a choice between those two paths. One is green and one is scorched. And it was our choice to make, you know, upon which path we were going to embark. And I'm pretty sure that that's where we are. So in this moment that you have with these movies and this time, think about that. There's some great films you're going to see. I wish I could stay for all of them. I'm hoping I can catch up on some of them. But what I want to tell you in closing, I told some of those people earlier today, is this little story. I was out in Washington, D.C., riding my horse. I already told you that part, right? I go to my teepee on the Washington Mall. I didn't tell you that part, right? Did you guys all hear that? The teepee on the Washington Mall. You like that? I was hanging out at my teepee on the Washington Mall. I always have to say Neil Young was hanging out at my teepee in the Washington Mall, too. Daryl Hannah. It's all people in my teepee at the Washington Mall. So then I'm hanging out at my teepee in the Washington Mall, and none of those celebrities are in there, and I'm there with my two 15-year-old boys, their 14th time. And this guy sticks his head in, and he says, Ms. LeDuc, you want to go for a ride in my car? And I'm like, that is such a great pickup line. You know, it's kind of 70s, 80s, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think guys say that anymore, but maybe they do, I don't know. Nobody's tried that lately. But anyway, so I'm like looking at the guy, and you know, my two 15-year-old sons are going, no, Mom, you're so not getting in that car with that guy, right? And the guy's like, I have a Tesla. And I'm like, oh, I am so getting in that car, right? So I go out of my teepee, and I go walk over there, and this guy has a four-door red Tesla. And I get in the passenger seat, and I look, you know, under the hood. You guys got ideas. It's like no combustion engine, right? And the guy's name is Phil, and he charged it at his house on his solar panels. And I'm like, Phil, you are so cool, right? And so I'm hanging out with Phil, and we go riding around town. We actually went over to see my friend Ralph Nader in our Tesla, right? Ralph really liked that. And then I go back, and I get delivered back to my teepee. But my point is that this is my political stance. You know, at this point in my life, I'm 55 years old, and what I want is I want a graceful transition. I want a graceful transition out of the fossil fuel era. I want a little elegance. I don't want to crash my way out, right? I don't want my ecosystems collapsing, my lakes filled with oil, my rivers full of exploding trains and fireballs. I don't want, you know, climate change upon me in such a catastrophic way that I cannot survive. I want some elegant transition, you know? I want an organic, local economy of food and energy that is cool. I want to go, basically, my position is I want to go from a teepee to a Tesla, right? And you guys all think about that, you know? Because it is not that we cannot do it. We have all the opportunity to do the right thing. It's a question of our own manao. That's a Hawaiian word. It's like your power. Putting your power to it. And there's a lot of smart people in this room, and we're all privileged first world people. So I feel like let's do the right thing. And we have a really great evening and an awesome film festival. Me and my pals are going to hang out some, and then we're gonna head on east a little bit here. But miigwech, thank you for your time.
Thanks again to Winona LeDuc and Frozen River Film Festival for today's presentation. More information on Winona LeDuc can be found at www.honorearth.org. More information on the Frozen River Film Festival can be found at www.frff.org. I'm Terry Tunset, and you've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.